For this Friday morning talk, it's exciting to see what I'm going to talk about. Now, this morning's talk, I wanted to talk about one of the other important subjects of Buddhism, especially with meditation, just so that the retreat is like a complete retreat, and that is about the Satipatthana, which many of you know means the four focuses of mindfulness, sometimes called the four foundations of mindfulness. And to give this description of these four foundations of mindfulness, or four focuses of mindfulness, in the way I practice them, in the way I understand them from the Buddha's teachings, from the suttas, and to illustrate just how throughout this retreat you've already been practicing the Satipatthana just about most of the time. Because this Satipatthana is part of the Eightfold Path, and it's sometimes people get a bit of difficulty understanding what actually it is and how it is performed. And today, hopefully, I'll give an indication on what the Satipatthana mean and how they're practiced, and also why they produce the results of deep insights, and also what particular insights you should be looking for. Because when we talk about Satipatthana, the word, the second half of that phrase, it means really the focusing of mindfulness, actually where you're going to put it. Because mindfulness can go on any object whatsoever. You can be mindful of your breakfast. I hope you were anyway. Completely mindful of every spoon which you raise and you put into your mouth and chew. You can be mindful of like eating toast. But it doesn't really sort of get you enlightened when you're sort of mindful of eating toast. You just, you find you probably get a better digestion and you enjoy it more. However, it doesn't really give those really powerful insights into the nature of being. Sometimes, though, you may be able to get the insight that toast is impermanent, especially the way you eat it so fast. It doesn't last very long when it's on your plate. But whatever, that's not the real insights we're trying to gather up here. The insights we're trying to gather up here, especially with Satipatthana, as I point out, is again this insight into, here we go again, non-self. And that's why I want to bring it up today, just to clarify and reinforce some of the things I was saying last night. So the Satipatthana is a focusing of mindfulness, and especially for a particular purpose, for a particular goal. And that is the goal of actually seeing non-self. Usually, seeing non-self through the factors of just things disappearing, passing away, vanishing. And because this is where you start to see that that which you thought was real and solid, when you see it sort of disappear and fade away, then the realization comes, perhaps this is not as solid as I really thought. Perhaps it was not a place I could rest my hat on, the hat of self, identity. When you start to see it all fade away and disappear, become fragmentary and then completely vanish, poof, gone. So this is actually one of the functions, perhaps the main function of Satipatthana, to be able to see certain things in a way that manifests their impermanence, their instability, their inconstancy, in order to get the realization, the insight, the powerful insight that this thing cannot be you. You've been identified with something which is just ephemeral, like a ghost, like a piece of mist. It's like when you were a kid, you look up and see the clouds, and you think that somehow they're solid balls of cotton wool or whatever. Then one day, first time you get in an aeroplane, you go up there, and you just pass right through them. And they're just fluff, they're just nothing, they're just mist. There's nothing solid to them at all. Only down here they look really solid, as if you could sit on them if you could only get a ladder that high. However, it just shows that somehow the way we look at things is not the way they truly are. And it's to see the way things truly are, especially to see the way some of these things we identify as a self truly are, what they really are, not what they appear to be. But when we actually look at the Satipatthana, you see, before you actually start to focus your mindfulness, you have to establish it and sustain it. Because without establishing mindfulness and without sustaining it, the Satipatthana just can't be done. These are like prerequisites for gaining insight. Having clear mindfulness and having stability of mindfulness. The clear mindfulness, again, it's coming from the practice you've been doing. You find that sometimes when mindfulness is dissipated, when you're doing so many things, then it's very hard for you to get strong mindfulness. It's as if you're too widely spread out. And it's one of the reasons why in our meditation we start to focus things in. This mindfulness, this function of the mind to know, to be aware, to see what's going on. If it's like too dissipated, the mindfulness becomes dull. But if we can somehow bring it together and put it on one thing, you find it starts to become sharper. It has more energy to it when the energy is not being spread out so thinly. And this is always what happens when we do any type of meditation for any length of time. The mindfulness starts to get sharper. You start to become more aware of things. It's as if the lights in your mind start to go up and you start to see more clearly. This is almost a clarifying of your function of consciousness. Even what you see seems to be more clear and you sort of pick out more details. Again, using that simile of mindfulness, like being like a light in your mind. You know what it's like here in the evening, just before we do the chanting, when we've only maybe got the candles lit and the lights are all turned off. You can only just about see people in this room. You just see their silhouette. You can't see any details in them. For example, you can't see if they're a man, if they've had a shave or not. Because it's not clear enough for that, to pick out those sorts of details. But once you put the lights on, especially if you put some big lights on, and if you have one of those spotlights like on a stage, then you can see everything. You know, whether that person's had a shave or not, whether the leading actress has got pimples or whatever, because that's if they haven't got a good makeup artist, because the flash or the spotlight really illuminates what's going on there. And you see much more of reality than you'd otherwise expect. I mentioned this the other day, I think, in Nolamara, that I remember like as a young man. And this made an impression on me, that whenever I went out with girlfriends, it was always at night time, and you couldn't really see them clearly. And when you took them into to parties or discos, the lights were always dimmed. And even at the restaurants, you'd always eat by candlelight. And sometimes, so you could actually see really what's going on there, who you're going out with. And it was true, I mean, the sort of the girlfriends looked much different at night time than they did during the day. So you can start to see here that sometimes people don't really want to be mindful, because their mindfulness might reveal some facets to their experience they're not really willing to face. However, putting that aside, that when we're really trying to practice mindfulness for wisdom, when we really want to find out the way things truly are, not the nice sort of fuzzy fantasy world of the way we hope they are, we really want to find out what our girlfriend looks like, or we want to find out what our mind looks like, then we truly have to turn up the lights in our mind. Even when we see something we don't want to see. You have to be courageous if you're going to develop mindfulness. Because sometimes there comes a point where you see something which, you know, just disturbs you a little bit. And what happens then? Very often either you just turn away from it, or sometimes you just don't want to develop mindfulness. And instead you develop sloth and torpor, the fuzzy mind, which is a direct opposite to mindfulness. Mindfulness in this aspect here is a clarity of the mind. Sloth and torpor, the dullness, the drugness, the alcoholic stupor, this is all a way of escaping from actually seeing life as it truly is. There's a little bit of wisdom in there, because something knows that that is painful out there.
or it's not quite the way you want it to be. So you decide just to not look at it at all. So mindfulness takes courage. That's a point, first of all. And mindfulness takes some effort to arouse. That's why they say in the Satipatthana Sutta that to develop each of these focuses, you have to be atapi. Atapi satama sampajana. Atapi means you have to really put forth some effort to become mindful. Usually the nature of the human beings is to be lazy. You know, if you don't really have to do something, you don't. And never do today what you can put off till tomorrow. That sort of attitude of the mind, which will always be sort of a lazy sort of attitude. And without the effort, you find the mindfulness doesn't get sharp. It's not easy to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. Hopefully now you've got into the habit during this retreat, you can get up at 4 o'clock in the morning when you go home again. No? Ah, come on. Remember what I was saying about an hour of your sleep is worth 5 years extra in your life, a quality time? Anyway, like getting up early in the morning takes effort, and being mindful takes effort. It's that atapi. You have to keep on developing. But it's the effort which really works in meditation, in mindfulness training, is that constancy of effort. Because very often that people put forth effort in a meditation or meditation retreat right at the very beginning, but they don't have the ability to sustain it. As I was saying in that talk on the Iddhipadas, or the five spiritual faculties, that it's the sustaining of these things produces the results. So what one is actually doing when one is, say, meditating on the breath, or meditating on present moment, or silence, or whatever, you're actually developing this mindfulness. And it takes effort, the continuity of effort. But if you, with these Iddhipadas, if you make your goal and sustain your attention on it, you find that mindfulness starts to establish itself in you. You become more sensitive, more aware, as if the light in your mind are being turned up. There will obviously be times when the mind rebels and goes off into sleepiness or dullness, sloth and torpor, but there will be many moments of your day when you are actually very aware. However, that sometimes in the context of a retreat, sometimes you don't notice those changes. Yesterday when I had to leave the centre here to go to the monastery for some urgent business, not just even just going out of this complex here and just going into Vincent Street, just the traffic, and it was 7:30 in the morning, it wasn't heavy traffic by any stretch of the imagination, it was very grating on the consciousness. It was actually quite painful just to look at, simply because my mindfulness had got subtle enough in those few days that to face all of that busyness was like chaos. It was like bedlam out there. I'm glad I didn't leave at sort of 8:30 in the rush hour when there's a lot of traffic. But you find that you do develop the mindfulness in this retreat. The lights get turned on, you start to see more, which is one of the first things we are doing here, which is one of the first benefits of this meditation. Now, it really doesn't matter what your meditation object is, whether it is the present moment, or silence, or the breath, or a mantra, or loving kindness, or whatever. This is like just the tool in the gym. The equipment which you use to get strong. It could be a rowing machine, it could be a cycling machine, it can be weights. I don't know what else you have in a gym, because I've never been in one. But whatever it is there, whatever the equipment is, it's always to get you like strong and to build up muscles. And these meditation objects are to build up those muscles of mindfulness and clarity. You have to be very clear to be able to keep hold of a meditation object and see exactly what's going on, to be able to see all the obstacles and difficulties which arise from time to time, to make sure you keep on track. This is all like the function of mindfulness. And eventually, through these and this different equipment in this gym here, that you actually build up mindfulness and it becomes quite strong. However, just having strong mindfulness, clear mindfulness, is not enough for the task. You may have a really bright lights in your mind, as it were. I'm not talking about nimittas now. This is just a metaphorical fact. You're really aware and very sharply seeing whatever's happening. Now, that's not enough to gain insight. The other preliminary aspect of the Satipatthanas, which is never or very rarely pointed out and emphasized enough, is that you have to be able to sustain that attention, sustain that mindfulness on your chosen object. The mindfulness has to be bright, but it also has to be still in order for you to penetrate the meaning of an object. For example, if you have a problem in your meditation, a difficulty, I think, hopefully anyway, by now you've got the message that the way to overcome that obstacle is focus your mindfulness on it long enough to find out exactly what is going on. Whether it's a problem at work, or a problem with your computer, or even a problem with your body, and you go and see a doctor. A superficial examination is not enough to find out what's wrong with you. You've got to focus your attention on that long enough to pick up all of the data, get all of the signals, to find out, ah, yeah, that's what the problem is. Because everyone knows, they've ever been to see a doctor who is bulk billing, that when they just do like a 10-minute sort of examination of you, you know it's not enough to really find out what's wrong. Sometimes it takes much longer than that, sustained attention, sustained investigation, to really find out what's happening. And this faculty, which we call sustained attention or sustained mindfulness, is this thing we call samadhi. And this is why that I really encourage the development of samadhi, because it is what empowers mindfulness to really bore in to the object under consideration, to be able to dig out the treasure which is buried deep inside of it. The practice of samadhi is actually well known to people, and its results are also quite well known. You start to see a different aspect on reality when you sustain attention on something, which really shows just how superficial your knowledge really is of the world. And you may have heard me here before that once you've done a bit of meditation for a few days, you can start to pick up anything and sustain your attention on it and be able to observe it in a way you've never observed before, to see things in that which you never expected to see, which you didn't even believe were in there. You can even just look down at the carpet in front of you. And you've been walking on this carpet, sitting on it for I don't know how many days now, 7 days almost. If you really look at it with samadhi, sustain your attention on it, without sort of a mind wandering away, without it thinking about what we're supposed to be doing this for and what we're going to do next, just sustain your attention on it, you find that your initial perceptions start to change and you start to see more and more. It is as if your attention starts to bore into the carpet. Initially you might just see grey, then you see all the different colours, how they're arranged, you might see patterns in there, you see textures, and if you look long enough it starts to change even in magical ways. I remember reading a little booklet actually in the BPS Wheel series about a psychologist in the United States who was an experiment. He paid a few people quite a sum of money just to look at a jar all day for many days in a row. Some people do anything for money. Just an ordinary jar like what you put flowers in. And of course a few of these people, even though they were being paid to do this experiment, and that's all they were told, just look at it and keep gazing at it and don't gaze anywhere else. A few of these people, even though they're being paid, gave up because it was boring or gave them a headache or whatever. But of those sort of volunteers, there was two or three who could actually, either because of the desire or need for the money, or because they had some other abilities to actually enjoy just staring at a jar for all day, for many days, they actually did that. And they explain what happened to them after a day or two. I think obviously they give up at night time and go and have a rest and come back in the morning and get their jar again. Not a bad job, really. And when they picked up their jar and started to sustain their attention on it, then a few of them actually described their experiences, and it was written up in this article. And what they started to experience was like there came a point, you know, where the jar started to become very bright and iridescent, and the colours started to jump out at them, and the whole thing started to melt away and change and become completely different. You know, the ordinary way of seeing the jar had disappeared, and perception was just playing around with this jar and seeing all sorts of amazing, wonderful things. And once they got into that mode, they said they looked out the window, and even the trees seemed to be iridescent, greener than green. Everything seemed to be glowing, even the people outside. And this was just with practicing on a jar. So if you've been trying on the breath, and you're trying on metta, and you haven't worked yet, go and get yourself a jar from the kitchen. Sustained attention is what it is. But what the important, the other thing I should have mentioned is, also they said when this happened, it starts to become incredible fun. They're really enjoying it. When the sort of the jar starts to explode into colour, they're experiencing a sense of bliss, joy, happiness. The mind was enjoying doing this, and it was also incredibly fascinating to see actually how a jar could sort of hold so many secrets. Now you can obviously see the parallels here between what you've been doing, you know, all this breath meditation, samadhi nimittas, getting into bliss or whatever. This is very similar to what you're doing. You're developing the ability to sustain attention on something long enough for it to reveal its secrets. And I love to give here the simile of the 1,000-petal lotus, because this also shows just how sustained attention works to uncover the nature of you, the nature of this mind, the nature of this body. And some of you have heard this simile before, but it's a very powerful one. Because in nature, a lotus in a lake closes its leaves at night time. And in the morning, once the sun comes up and starts to warm the lotus, then is that the signal, the trigger, for the leaves to start to open. And it takes quite a long time, many minutes, for the outermost leaves of the lotus to open. And it only opens if there's warmth there. If it's a cloudy day, then it takes a long time to open. Obviously, if it's no clouds at all, and the sun is directly on the lotus, there's no obstacles, then the outermost leaves open very quickly. It's only when the outermost leaves are opened can the sun start to warm the next layer of leaves or petals, and then they open up. And you've seen lotuses in nature, you've seen pictures of lotuses. They have many layers of leaves or petals until they're all fully opened. And so it takes quite a while for the lotus to fully open when the sun is upon it. Now in the simile of the 1,000-petaled lotus, you may have heard that word before used in Buddhism, the 1,000-petaled lotus. It's a simile for body, mind, you, or whatever you wish to call it. This thing which is sitting here on the mat, on the cushion, which you're sustaining your attention on. The sustaining of the attention is like the sun warming the outermost petals of that 1,000-petaled lotus. And you know that when you sustain attention on the nature of yourself, it takes a long time for the first petal to open up. And if that sustained attention isn't strong, if there's some obstruction there, some hindrance, the outermost petal will hardly open at all, let alone the innermost petals. But if you have clarity of mindfulness, in other words, the sun is strong and unimpeded, if it's sustained, that clarity is put on the lotus and not put anywhere else for a while, then the outermost leaf opens up. Just like the person watching the jar. After a while, the outermost leaf, being the ordinary perceptions of a jar, all that you've been told, all that you've been learned before, is just a jar, something you put flowers in. All those ordinary perceptions, your learnt knowledge, opens up and you see what's underneath there. A second layer of knowledge. Very often, because you haven't sustained attention on these things long enough, that's the limit of your knowledge. It's the outermost petal of the lotus. And that's why that when they start to sustain attention on a jar, and the sort of the other levels of what a jar actually is start to manifest, it becomes really fascinating. The first time you've seen a jar in a completely different light. You thought you knew what a jar was. Now you realize just how little you knew. You thought you knew what a carpet was. But if you sustain attention on it, it completely transforms. You thought you knew who you were. But when you sustain attention on it, you start to see things which you never ever expected. However, the reason why in this sim it's called a thousand petal lotus is because there's thousands of levels of reality there which you have to uncover. The practice of meditation does take many hours of sitting, many uncoverings of different layers of delusion and fantasy and wrong ideas about yourself and the world. When the Buddha taught that the main cause of human suffering, the root problem, is avijja, or illusion, he didn't say this was something which was very easy to uncover. It is uncovered, as it were, in layers, like opening the petals of a lotus. And it becomes a danger which you should always recognize in meditation, in your spiritual life, that sometimes that the sun beams on the lotus and many of the leaves open up, and maybe you've 50 petals have already opened up and you're on petal number 950 of the thousand petal lotus. But the 50th petal is just so beautiful, you think, wow, this is it. I finally understood, I finally discovered what's at the heart of this lotus. Sorry mate, you've got another 950 petals to go now. Sometimes people assume they're enlightened because they've got into a very interesting, very powerful, very beautiful experience. You know, the many petals, which for most people don't open at all, they've opened and they've seen a reality which is very deep and very profound, very strange and wonderful and very rare in this world. But be careful. It's not fully enlightened yet. You have to sustain attention on this so long that so many petals open up. 50th, 100th, 200th, 300th, 900th, 950th, 980th, 990th, 999th, and you get to the last petal, and that opens up. In the simile, they say you see the jewel in the heart of the lotus. You know what that jewel is? Is it a diamond? Is it a ruby? It's emptiness. You see the great emptiness in the heart of the lotus, which is not what you ever expect. That's how you know it's different than any other petal. Emptiness is something of a completely different character than just another petal, than just another thing. No thing. But to be able to do this, again, the most difficult thing is to sustain your attention on the lotus long enough, and also to know which lotus you have to look on. Whether you should sustain your attention on a jar, on a carpet, on a lotus, or a rose, or whatever. And the purpose of the four focuses of mindfulness is to say, once you develop samadhi, the ability to sustain attention, once the mindfulness is strong enough, bright enough, then put your attention on one of these four lotuses. On this thing we call body, on this thing we call like Vedana. I have to just spend a few moments explaining this term, because the usual translation is called feelings, but in English feelings is such a wide word, it's usually mean emotional states or physical sensations in the body, which is not the meaning of Vedana in Pali. It's not what the second of the focuses of mindfulness is talking about. Vedana means that aspect of any conscious experience, whether it's sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, or mind consciousness, that aspect which is pleasant, painful, or somewhere in between. If it's relating to what you see, we call Vedana, we call it beautiful or ugly, or just neutral. If it's sound, we call it pleasant sound, grating sound, or just somewhere in between. If it's body consciousness, we call it pain, we call it pleasure, or again in between. But that which is painful, that quality which is common to pain, which is common to ugliness, which is common to grating sound, that is the dukkha vedana, the unpleasant vedana. That quality which is in beauty with what you see, or the very sonorous sounds which you hear, or the very pleasant sensations in the body, that quality which is common to those is called sukha vedana, the happy feeling, the happy aspect of conscious experience. And that which is in between, which is common to all, is this neither pain nor pleasure vedana. So this is the aspect of conscious experience which, very loosely speaking, generally speaking, is pleasure or pain. But not just with the physical body. Pleasure and painful mind states, pleasure and painful smells, pleasure and painful tastes. So it's the aspect of pleasure and pain in all of the sensory experiences. That's what Vedana is. And that was the second of these focuses of mindfulness, of the Satipatthana. And the third is citta, otherwise known as like consciousness or mind consciousness. And I did spend quite a while yesterday just talking about how consciousness works, what consciousness is. Because for many people, they use the word consciousness so often without really understanding what they're talking about, and actually looking deeply and finding out what consciousness actually is. Because there's an overlap between this activity of the which we call mind and these other sensory consciousnesses, and the illusion of a self. You can think, I am because I am conscious, that consciousness is me. Anyway, that this is the third of those lotuses to put your attention on, consciousness itself. And the last of the Satipatthanas, or focuses of consciousness, is the objects of mind, the concepts, the thoughts, the experiences. And if you like, you can have that third Satipatthana, consciousness, is what's in here, what's experiencing all of this. Put your attention on that. You focus attention on that for long periods of time until it all opens up. And what's out there is the last of the Satipatthanas. Now the inner and the outer, as it were. So these become like the four focuses of mindfulness. Now, it's also important to have an idea of what you're doing this all for. Because if you're doing something and you haven't got any idea what the goal is, then one, you don't know if you've finished or not, or how far you're going, you get very discouraged very easily. And also, it doesn't give a direction to the practice. It's quite important sometimes to at least have some idea of where this is all heading for, even though you might not fully understand it. At least it gives the practice a direction. And in the Satipatthana Suttas, if you read them very carefully, you find out the whole purpose of doing this, sustaining your attention on this, is to uncover those truths of inconstancy, or impermanence, or cessation, and non-self. As the Buddha actually said in the Satipatthana Sutta, just to see that this is just body, that's all. This is just Vedana, that's all. This is just consciousness, that's all. This is just the objects of consciousness, that's all. But not anything more profound or deep than that. Not a God, not a universal consciousness, not a cosmic reality, not the ground of all being, not me, not a self, not anything. Just body. It's just a lotus. An emptiness inside. What you thought was substantial was just the petals on the outside. So, that is the function of it. That is where it's aiming at. That's what the Buddha said, if you do this, this is where it will lead. So that this is the practice, the path, to be able to realize through experience, through insight, what is impermanence, what the Buddha was meaning about that term, what is non-self, what the Buddha was meaning about that. Is why the other day, when I gave the talk on anatta, I did mention to one question, I said, I don't actually expect you to understand this yet, or to accept it. The reason I said that is because just talking about it, just explaining it, is not enough to understand it. It just gets you into the vicinity, gives you suggestions. It is this way of Satipatthana, which is the way to truly uncover the truth of this. Sustain your attention on it. One of the things with sustaining your attention on something, that again, all that your past ideas and knowledge, they're all about the outer leaves. So sustaining your attention on something requires you eventually to abandon all your old knowledge, all your old ideas, all your old thoughts. Because it's these things which obstruct us from seeing clearly. It's these things which stop us from appreciating the reality of things. You know, that sometimes I used to give these talks about what it was like in Thailand as a young monk, sort of 23, 24 years ago, you know, eating snails and eating frogs, you know, boiled frogs, just big enough for your spoon. So you just had to put them on your spoon and put them into the mouth and go crunch. Have you ever eaten a frog like that before? And why do you go, ugh, yuck? You see what I mean about preconceived ideas? That's why I was telling this story, just as an example, just to show how the outermost petals of the lotus, you expect a frog to taste awful. Just a boiled frog. How do you know? You see the difference between preconceived ideas and insight? We expect there to be a self in here. You see the difference between preconceived ideas and true knowledge? How, actually, because that you all assume, you're all absolutely certain the boiled frog tastes terrible. But when you eat it, it will taste terrible. But isn't it strange that a northeast Thai would eat that and say it's delicious? So where does the awful taste or the deliciousness lie? Is it in the frog? Or is it in the mouth of the person who eats it? is an assumption which people carry with them. Same with light cheeses. Once when I went down to Bangkok, I was staying in one of the monasteries there in Wat Pawan, and one of the one of the supporters there was like a captain, I think, in one of the Thai Airways years ago. He'd just gone to England, met one of the monks' mothers, and the mothers has given all these beautiful cheeses from England, you know, Stilton's, blue cheeses, all these wonderful cheeses. And they came and brought it in the afternoon. We couldn't eat it in the afternoon there, so they said, we're going to offer it tomorrow morning for lunch. And so we gave it to one of the temple boys to look after, because we couldn't keep it, it was against our rules. And in the morning, we're all looking forward to getting the cheese. And he didn't offer it. Where's the cheese? Oh, it's gone all mouldy and blue, so I threw it away. Because to a Thai, so that cheese was the grossest, smelliest, awful stuff. I don't know how anyone could even look at it, let alone put it in their mouth. There's a good reason for that. So sometimes that our views of the world, especially like Vedana, one of the focuses of the mindfulness, what is pleasant and what is painful? How much of that is reality and how much of that is just outermost petals of a lotus? And with like pleasure and pain, it's very important to us, isn't it? We spend a great deal of time trying to search out pleasure and trying to get hold of it and maintain it and keep it at our beck and command. We try a lot of times, so much effort, trying to get rid of aches and pains and things we don't like. Is it really pain? Is that really pleasure? Or is it just like the Thai boy, just throwing away sort of what he thinks is painful, but is actually really pleasurable? Or like a Westerner, just throwing away a frog, because you assume, absolutely, it must taste terrible. And actually, it might be quite nice. Especially chocolate-covered ones. Anyway... Anyway, the point is that once you start to sustain your attention on something, all these old stuff, these old ideas, all your cultural conditioning, whether it's from the West, whether it's from the East, whether it's a Sri Lankan conditioning or American conditioning or Australian, English, Italian, German or whatever, all of that lies on the outermost leaves. And when I said that so much of like willpower is conditioned, so much of your understanding is conditioned, so much of the way you look at the world is conditioned, wow, you actually see that. Only when those outermost petals disappear, when you go to a way of seeing which you've never experienced before, you actually see the object in a completely different way. And just shows you just how perception can change and how wide it can be and how limited you are. I gave a simile, and it's the best simile I can get for perception. It's like going in the supermarket and you want to get some, say, cereals, and there's so many different types of cereals on the shelves. Even if it's like cornflakes. There's so many different types of cornflakes, organically grown corn, non-organically grown corn, with different ingredients or no ingredients. There's so much stuff up there. What happens when you go in the supermarket shelf? This is what I used to do years ago. I've been in the supermarket for over 23 years now. You always go to the same type of packet which you're used to. In the habit of always getting the same packet, because that's what you like, that's what you're used to. There might be a new brand just come out, which is supposed to taste so much better. Doesn't matter. Get the old packet, because that's what you're used to. How much we are creatures of habits. Even though the new packet costs less, even though it's more nutritious, even though it's much better for you, still we take the old packet down. It doesn't matter if it's better, or it's truer, or it's more nutritious, or better for us. We keep on doing the old habits, because we're used to it, and we feel comfortable with it. It doesn't matter if new knowledge, new understanding is better. We're comfortable with the old understanding. In one of the suttas, the Buddha gave this very beautiful story. He said these two men, they heard that a certain country, because of some disease or some war, pestilence, they abandoned the towns and the villages there. And so they thought, well, you know, it's a long way away, but if we go there, we may be able to find something which someone has left there or abandoned. So the two of them went together there,